Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. What Me Worry? The Art and Humor of Mad Magazine is a new exhibition at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, that explores the unforgettable art and satire of Mad Magazine from its beginning in 1952 to its emergence as a beloved magazine that spoke truth to power and attracted generations of devoted readers through the decades. When I received word of the Mad exhibit on the horizon, I said, I wish Brian were here. In this case, Brian Shields, a broadcasting legend who was with WAMC for 30 years before retiring in 2019. So how do you coax a belligerent broadcaster out of retirement? It turns out you ask them.
And I was glad to be asked, Joe. I grew up with Mad Magazine. It was a part of my childhood and my adulthood. This is a subject I know pretty well. What could go wrong, returning to the mic to talk about some heroes of mine? What Me Worry? While we were at the museum, Sarah LaDuke and I recorded an audio tour to give an overview of the exhibition. The tour was led by satirical illustrator and caricaturist and exhibition co-curator Steve Brodner and Norman Rockwell Museum's chief curator, Stephanie Plunkett.
We've been thinking about Mad Magazine for a few years, and of course the museum is dedicated to the art of illustration, and Mad over its more than 70-year history has had an extraordinary group of artists and writers and art directors and editors working to create satirical illustrations that are based upon real life and help us to think a little bit about thinking and the realization that not everything we see and read is actually true.
Does Mad Magazine have any specific or direct connections to Norman Rockwell himself, the person?
Well, the wonderful thing is that when we started this project, we didn't think so. But what we discovered was that in our archives, we actually had some letters from the editor, Al Feldstein, of Mad, and also the art director, John Putnam, who lived in Stockbridge. And they had invited Norman Rockwell in 1964 to create what they called essentially the ultimate portrait of Alfred E. Newman. They wanted a realistic portrait of him, the logo. And Rockwell apparently thought about it. He even actually seems to have committed to it and then declined the offer, basically saying that, he had discussed it with his wife, who had more common sense than he did, and ultimately, he felt that it probably wouldn't be appropriate and they would all get into a mess.
There are so many decades of content, of art and humor and thought and essays available to put into the show. How did you work on curating it? And tell me about the people you worked with and what you had to consider.
Our wonderful co-curator, Steve Brodner, who's really today's most inspiring and most important satirical illustrator, having just received the Herblock Prize. We put together an advisory of 10 people, a combination of scholars, art directors, illustrators, and writers from the magazine, who gave us tremendous background and great thinking about how to organize such a vast exhibition.
We're standing here in what you might call the Alfred E. Newman room, I guess. And what is it about him, his appeal, do you think? Is there a little Alfred E. Newman in everybody?
I think there is, because when he was invented, I think, Al Feldstein wanted him to be a kind of a wiseacre, not necessarily foolish, but sort of always having that glint of knowledge behind his eyes. And it's really a wonderful story, because we think of Alfred E. Newman as being totally Mad's character. But in fact, the face, that appearance of the boy with a gap tooth and ears that stick out, comes from the 19th century in advertising. So he was a face that appeared on signs for painless dentistry, on tonics that contained heroin and cocaine, on playbills, and even in the 1940s, actually, in advertising for Franklin D. Roosevelt's 1940 campaign. So it was a prevalent face. Very fortunately, Mad started to incorporate that face into their art and then kind of cemented the fact that Alfred would be named in 1956, and the first portrait was done by Norman Mingo, who came out of retirement at the age of 60 to paint the definitive portrait.
Steve, we want to get you in here, of course. What does Mad Magazine mean to you, and how did you approach helping organize the exhibition?
Well, I came to it as a fan. Like so many of us, it became the most important part of our cultural life. I didn't subscribe because my parents would never do such a thing.
Sure.
But I grew up in Brooklyn, and we had candy stores. They were also massive magazine racks. And so there was every magazine in the United States, plus all the newspapers, plus every comic, and Mad. So I would haunt the candy stores for the new one every month. And in the pages of Mad, you would see grown-ups telling you as a kid, it's all bullshit. And we know it's all bullshit. And we know you know it's all bullshit. And can't we have fun with that understanding, even though your parents will never agree with you, they'll never agree with us. You won't find that message in advertising, movies, television, any of it. But it's basically nonsense. And you and we are on the same wavelength on this. And the greatest artists. And that's how I became cartoonist, illustrator, and also taught me how to put jokes together. There was always that attitude of, all right, we have the premise of the stupid stuff we see. What if we just extend it a little bit, you know? Try to push it a little bit more. And that's where satire comes from.
And the satire was always sharp and pointed, but it was never mean. Mean-spirited, was it?
Mean-spirited, but it was implicitly mean. It was the implication was that there's a corruption here. We're having fun by just playing with it a little bit, but the minute you start to break the skin of hypocrisy, all manner of stuff can happen. And that's what Mad was doing. It was breaking the bubble of the monoculture, the cultural set of preconceived solid ideas from the 1950s and 60s, when there was much more conformity than there is now.
One of my favorites, early satires, was East Side Story. Do you remember that one? It was based on West Side Story, but it was Khrushchev.
Yes.
Khrushchev versus Kennedy, and the gangs were fighting over the turf at the UN. But they didn't talk down to kids. They knew kids were smart enough to understand about Khrushchev and Kennedy and West Side Story.
The kids, they don't know about it, are going to then start to get informed about it. So it was a way of informing us. There were words we didn't know, and you would look them up, or just by osmosis begin to understand what those words mean. The way, you know, one learns through reading. So it was a really, for some of us, our first encounter with verse, with parody, with this winking knowledge that it's a joke, that it's an extension of reality. Satire requires that, requires an understanding that we know that this is not serious. This is what we're saying is actually code for saying something else. When you're in a city, you are exposed to great diversity. This was telling you that there is a complicated world out there. It's not just, you know, what you get in the Boy Scouts or church or television and your parents. That's not even scraping the surface of reality. So here's an invitation to read, to be educated, to find out about all the diversity of the world, which is vast.
And the exhibition here is also incredibly vast. Stephanie, could you tell me what is the theme, I suppose, of this first room?
So the way that the exhibition is organized is according to editorial periods. It is somewhat of a chronology, beginning with the earliest in 1952, when Mad started as a comic book, and moves forward to its transition to a magazine in 1955. Within the exhibition, there are also sidebars. So, for example, helping people understand who Alfred E. Newman was, or something about their vast catalog of television and movie parodies and politics. So these are some of the main themes that came forward in the magazine, but we have a really wonderful section on Spy versus Spy, which is always a great favorite.
There is a room filled with Spy versus Spy artwork. The strip was created by Cuban cartoonist Antonio Prohias and debuted in 1961. Joe Donahue sat down in the gallery with Peter Cooper, the current mind behind Spy versus Spy.
Spy versus Spy is a wordless comic strip featuring two agents involved in espionage activities. One wears white attire while the other dons black, yet their appearances are otherwise indistinguishable. They're chiefly recognized by their elongated beak-like heads adorned with black eyes and white pupils. Spy vs. Spy is currently written and drawn by Peter Cooper, who took over as the full-time writer and artist for the strip with Mad Magazine, number 356, in April of 1997. Peter is a regular contributor to The New Yorker, The Nation, and Mad Magazine, where he has written and illustrated Spy vs. Spy every issue since 1997. He is the co-founder and editor of World War III Illustrated, a political graphics magazine that has given a forum to political artists for 40 years. Peter, what a pleasure to have you at this special roundtable edition at the Norman Rockwell Museum.
Thank you. And it's an incredible honor to be in a gallery filled with mad art.
So if this story is true, it's unbelievable, which is at some point in your life, you knock on Norman Rockwell's door while he's here in Stockbridge. You're a young artist. And you say what?
Well, I show him a couple of my drawings. I think one was a robot and maybe one was a barbarian. And I had been to my parents brought me here when I was 12 at the time. And we went to the Norman Rockwell Museum, which was a small little house. And it completely blew my mind. And my parents, wonderful people, bought me a Norman Rockwell book. And the person at the counter said, oh, yeah, he lives down the street. So my father drove me up to his studio. And then he kind of shooed me in there. You go in by yourself. I brought my two drawings. I went in, knocked on the door. There's Norman Rockwell. It was a summer day. Light is coming through the window. You see the dust in the air. He's, of course, working on a portrait of Lincoln, you know, naturally. There's his easel that has the iconic helmet on top that he had in his self-portrait. And I, you know, mousily went up to him and said, you know, hi, I love your work. And here's some of my drawings. And he looked at them dutifully, nodded for a bit, and then said, draw from life. And I was thinking, I wish he had said, draw from mad. But, you know, that's Norman Rockwell, you know. So, but it really did have a seismic impact on me, because I then read about Norman Rockwell. And when I moved to New York from Cleveland, I went to the Art Students League for a few semesters, because I had read that he had gone there, and that I actually loved Rockwell's cartooning sensibility. And you see it in a lot of his paintings, that he actually, that ability to not, it's not just a replication of reality, but there's just the way he stretches some things, the way the figures are standing. And even he had a whole page that was about his studio burning down, and it was a comic. And I showed it in, I teach comics now and at Harvard, and I show his work in my class as examples of that kind of crossover between illustration and cartooning.
You talk about you wish that he had said draw from mad. Mad was a huge influence as well. Do you remember making a connection with Spy versus Spy when you first saw it?
Oh, absolutely. Like most young kids, because I started looking at it when I was, I don't know, 8 years old, the first thing I would look at was Spy versus Spy. I was disappointed if it wasn't in the issue, because it only ran maybe 8 times a year at that point. And every one of those, that puzzle was something without language, was... you read it before you read it. You know, you like you open the page and you're looking at it and you're already into the story. And I didn't realize how much that influenced me and my tendency to do wordless comics, which I do lots of to this day. In fact, I do a weekly wordless comic for Charlie Hebdo, the French magazine. And since I don't speak French, it being wordless is ideal. Looking at Prohias and then all those years, when Mad reached out to me and asked me to try out for Spy versus Spy, I actually almost first said no. because clearly I'm an idiot, which made me perfect for the usual gang. But I thought, well, I'll give it a whirl. I was doing my own thing, and Proheus, you know, this was somebody else's characters. And had I really wanted to get the job, I would have done it. I tried to mimic Proheus's beautiful pen and ink style. And instead, at the time, I was working in stencils and spray paint in my illustration. I'd done a book for DC Vertigo called The System, which was a 96-page wordless graphic novel. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it in my own style. And I figured that would be a good way to make the editors decide that I wasn't the right guy for the job. So I did my sample in stencils with spray cans and brought in this grayish, sprayy version of Spy versus Spy. And it turned out what they were looking for was something that was both, you know, represented the characters accurately and yet went somewhere else. And so I turned out to be their guy. And I thought, well, I'll do it for a year or two and move along. And right around the time maybe getting ideas was more difficult, Mad went to color, and then that opened up the world to rainbows and blood. So it was a whole bundle of new ideas could come to me. And here I am 28 years later still doing it.
What is it about Spy versus Spy that works? You talked about being that 8-year-old kid and just immediately being in the story, but what is it about the concept of it that works?
Well, right off the bat, wordless comics, it's an international language. There's no language barriers when you look at it. And so there's, no matter who you are, any language, you're going to be able to sort of tease out what's going on. And if you can't, you're at least sort of intrigued by the puzzle of it and trying to figure out what's going on and who's, and even for that matter, the way they look with this sort of bird-like beak. It's like this strange new kind of face, but it's something that therefore makes it even more unique and transcends a specific country or, you know, type of human. The subtext to Spy versus Spy is the Cold War. Proheus was actually fleeing Cuba because he had a death threat from Castro, because he was a political cartoonist and he was doing things that Castro didn't like, and he fled to the United States with pretty much his shirt on his back. And he came to the Mad offices. He spoke no English, and that was true throughout his whole career, which is quite amazing, which is another reason why, you know, it was perfect that Spy versus Spy was wordless, because he didn't have to try and translate it. And in fact, there's a great story where when the editors wanted to tell him, you know, respond to his work, like whether it was working or not, they would point to something and say, bueno. And then they point to the other part and go, el s***o, if they didn't like it. And I'm not going to use that from now on. They didn't do that with me as often, but that's perhaps because I speak English. But I did get that same response, however.
Peter Cooper, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
My pleasure to be here.
Spy versus Spy is currently drawn by Peter Cooper, who took over as the full-time writer and artist for the strip with Mad Magazine number 356 in April 1997. He spoke with Joe Donahue. What Me Worry, The Art and Humor of Mad Magazine, is a new exhibition at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. We return now to our audio tour with Steve Brodner and Stephanie Plunkett.
Steve, could you tell us about how this section of the exhibition is organized?
We have some more truckers. We have some Sam Vivianos. This wall over here is devoted to parodies of Norman Rockwell. We have, to me, one of the gems of the exhibition is this masterpiece by Richard Williams, which is a Rockwell parody of his super famous triple portrait. And because this is the Rockwell Museum, you can see it right next to the actual original. It's almost the same size as the Norman Rockwell original. It is handled with extraordinary technique and great observation, down to the folds in the shirt that Alfred E. Newman is wearing. We have to describe it. It's the originals of Rockwell, the back of his head as he's doing a self-portrait on his canvas. The biggest picture is his original pen and ink, his pencil sketch of himself with a pipe in his mouth looking at us. And in order to get the right info, Norman's got a mirror that he's looking at. looking quizzically at himself. So it's the back of his head, himself in the mirror, and then a full face portrait on the canvas. In the Richard Williams parody, it's exactly the same. Everything's the same. The Coca-Cola glass on the book.
Precariously positioned.
Precariously positioned. The highlighting on the chair, the exact same perspective, even the little rattan characteristic of the seat. And the mirror is not quite the same because instead of an eagle on the top, there is a goofy bird, dodo bird, I think. Alfred is looking at himself in the mirror, but what he's painting is the back of his own head. And then for reference, instead of Rembrandt and Picasso and others, he's got pinned to the sides portraits of Al Jaffe, Sergio Aragonés, Dave Berg, it looks like.
So it's a lot of parody in this space. What is in the next gallery, Stephanie?
You know, we very fortunately have kind of come through time. And in this gallery, I think one of the highlights is the very famous Folden images.
Al Jaffe came up with the idea for the fold-in back page feature, something he did for over 60 years. At the museum, there is a console where you can virtually do the mad fold-in, from the before to the after. Sitting before that console, Joe Donahue spoke with current Mad Fold-In artist Johnny Sampson.
Since 1964, a signature feature of Mad Magazine has been the fold-in, a cartoon riddle that is solved when the picture is folded. These days, the fold-in is conceived, written, sketched, and painted by cartoonist Johnny Sampson. For 55 years, Al Jaffe had been the creator of Mad's fold-in. From 1964 to 2019, Al's feature was a famously recognizable part of the magazine. And then a year before Jaffe's 100th birthday, he turned the project over to Johnny Sampson. Johnny Sampson joins us in the gallery this morning, where we are surrounded by Mad fold-ins, both by Al and by Johnny. What is that like for you?
To be honest, it's a little overwhelming. It made my heart swell seeing my work up on the wall alongside Al's.
The idea that at 99 you don't think of, oh, now I'll retire. But what was it that brought him to the point of saying, oh, okay, you can do this?
It's kind of a long, maybe not the longest story, but the short version of it is I did a parody of a fold-in for Pitchfork.com when they did their magazine called The Pitchfork Review. I was really happy with it, and I sent it to Al, and he wrote me back, and he was very impressed and asked if I'd be interested in doing it more often because he said, well, I'm in my 90s, and I won't be able to keep doing this forever, you know. And so I was flabbergasted. I just sent it for his acknowledgement. It wasn't like a job interview or an application or anything like that. But he set things in motion to meet the editors at Mad, including Sam Viviano. And Sam said, you know, he may be 92 at the time, but he still had a lot of gas in the tank. And he certainly did because he kept going till 99. And it's just astonishing the work that he put out. But yeah, I took over in 2020. That was after the move from New York to Burbank. So it was the new Mad. And when that transition happened, they actually didn't even know this that Al had suggested that I take it over until I visited. And, you know, I made a little comic about it called Truly Madly. And I gave it to them to read. And they're like, oh, well, this changes everything. Because apparently they had actually been wondering who's going to be able to take this over at some point.
What is the key to a successful Mad fold-in?
Well, I do feel like the image is that it lines up, for one. And two, that it's funny. And three, a lot of people pride themselves on being able to figure it out by just looking at it. But three would be, you know, just to make it a little more difficult for people to figure out. And so for me, that includes, you know, hiding the answer in the visual, but also in the text at the bottom. Like, I don't want a keyword hanging out on the edge because you're going to know what it says. So that can be the biggest challenge sometimes is making these words fit. Because, for instance, one, the answer was microplastics. And in order to make that word out of ordinary words. It was very challenging, to the point where I was, you know, I had already done the art and everything, and I was panicking because I'm like, I don't know if I can do this, you know. So it was done, but it was in, you know, it was in the English language. There was nouns following verbs, following adjectives, but Sam Viviano calls it fold in ease, I believe, and it's, if you read enough of them, you'll know what we're talking about, because it's English. It makes some kind of sense, although not the most.
I have never been diagnosed with OCD. However, I self-diagnosed because as a kid, I was just very pristine. And when I got my copy of Mad Magazine, folding it was really hard for me because I wanted to keep them like in a binder and have them all to be perfect. I always did, but man, it hurt.
Yeah, I was a Mad fan just like everybody else in this show. And when I had my subscription, I don't think I folded a single one. Kept the page rounded or curved so it wasn't creased at all. But lately I've been folding mine because I figure, I mean, if I'm folding it, it's got to increase in value, right?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that's what's so interesting about the video display here, because you can actually click on a Mad Magazine, do the fold in, it has the entire image, and then you, of course, can see the final product.
For sure. Yeah, that's helpful. But I have to say, nothing beats the paper version, because with the digital one, you don't have that line, the physical line of the paper crease. And I think that's important.
And you factor that in?
I do. And sometimes I had created some sort of line with it, and I was told you need to embellish a little more to make it. So it's not just solely for the digital version, but you have to take that into account.
I hope that you have great enjoyment, not only seeing Al's work and your work together, but all of these mad artists together. And I congratulate you on your participation in an absolutely gorgeous exhibit.
Thank you very much. This is a dream come true. I'm still just kind of in disbelief that I'm here in the museum with everybody else. Thanks for having me.
The Mad Fold-In was originated by Al Jaffe and is now conceived, written, sketched, and painted by cartoonist Johnny Sampson. Speaking with Joe Donahue. We'll be back with more from the Norman Rockwell Museum after this.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. What Me Worry? The Art and Humor of Mad Magazine is a new exhibition on view at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, through October 27th. There are many eye-catching parts to the exhibit. In one room, there is a large painting satirizing the Velvet art classic Dogs Playing Poker. In this case, dogs playing video games.
Scott Bricker was a childhood fan of Mad Magazine through freelancing connections. He eventually became a staff member. His work was some of the first in color for the magazine, and it's often a whirlwind ride of satirical content, bright and quite, yes, quite, quite mad. His association with Mad Magazine has lasted more than a decade, which has allowed him to express his sense of humor as well as practice his art and be all about Mad. Scott Bricker, a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Very happy to be here.
You have a gorgeous piece in this exhibit. I will ask a two-part question. One is, what is it like to be in this exhibit? But then also to have your work along with all of these other Mad artists, but also to then ask you specifically about this particular piece, which is really so lush and beautiful.
Well, I mean, it's a thrill to be, you know, at the Norman Rock Museum. Obviously, we live about an hour and 15 minutes south of here in Kent, Connecticut, and so we've been coming up here since the museum opened, so we're very familiar with the museum, and of course, you know, lifelong fan, you know, of Rockwell, so to be adjacent to him in this gallery is quite a thrill, and to be adjacent to all the history of MAD, you know, all these artists that I've admired. I mean, the exhibition seems so familiar because you know all the pieces, but to see the originals is just, you know, breathtaking to see the original, you know, the subtlety, the line work. I mean, it's just really dazzling and thrilling to be a part of it all.
Tell us about this particular piece.
Well, this particular piece was kind of funny because I was the first artist to start working digitally for MAD. When I first started working for them, I was working digitally, although I worked in traditional media, oil, watercolor, gouache, different things. So when I first started, they wanted me to work traditionally. So I would send in sketches digitally and then do them in watercolor and gouache and on paper and send them in. For this particular issue, I'd done something already for that issue, which was, you know, quite different from this. And then they called me and said, well, hey, we've got this idea for a center spread. It's going to be a poster. We want the dogs playing cards, but we want them playing video games. And so I said, great. And they said, but we need it by Monday. So basically, I just, you know, it was a bit of a crazy week in that I got the sketches approved and all that. And basically, I had to paint it over the weekend and deliver it wet on Monday morning. But it was a whirlwind. But, you know, it was great to be able to actually pull out the oil paint and do it in oil because they wanted it to look very traditional, very much like the original. And so I did my best to match that, which what I did a lot of that for MAD.
No velvet.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I do have a velvet painting of Elvis at my house for inspiration.
My final question, what's the current state of the magazine?
Well, most of it's, they do, you know, reprints, which MAD has always had a long history of reprinting things. But what you see on the newsstand now is about 90% reprinted material. So, you know, I'll look through and I'll see, you know, things turn up, you know, that I did many years ago because I worked for them for 20 years. So you go back through and you say, oh, wow, that showed up. And I did a lot of topical things, which don't age well. But some of the things, they'll do a theme issue. Maybe, you know, that'll fit in with ever. So it's kind of interesting to see what pops up.
I thank you so much for spending time with us. It's a delight to sit here in this gallery looking at your art and talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we last met up with Brian Shields and Sarah LeDuc, they were in the gallery with MAD Magazine's famous fold-ins. Time now to find out from curator Stephanie Plunkett, what else is there?
In addition, there are some really wonderful cartoons by some of the more contemporary illustrators. So work by Teresa Burns Parkhurst, Keith Knight, and others. Tom Bunk, who has this amazing underground comic feel with so many details in his work. But there's also a very rare original by Robert Crumb and his brother Charles Crumb, which was created for a magazine that they published when they were just teenagers, and it was called Foo. They were quite inspired by MAD to actually go into cartooning and to create magazines. It's actually the image right here in the middle with these very detailed drawings of all kinds of characters around the edges and great typography. But we do have a quote in the room by Robert Crumb, and it says, "Artists are always trying to equal the work that impressed them in their youth. I feel extremely inadequate when I look at old MAD comics."
MAD had its, I don't know if you call it competitors, but certainly copiers. Cracked Magazine, there was Crazy, you have a cover from Crazy, Sick Magazine. And Cracked just was a blatant ripoff, in my opinion. But a lot of bad imitations, which I guess Cracked went on for a while, but the rest of them really didn't.
That's the sincerest form of flattery. You know you're doing a good job when people try to imitate you, but they don't. They don't do a good job, and that tells you how good you are.
Also in this gallery, just relating to what you just said, is we have some really wonderful video of some of the inspirations that MAD has created.
There's a Family Guy clip on right now. I saw Simpsons earlier.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, a lot of late night television, Saturday Night Live. Remarkably, there is a clip of Fred Astaire dancing with an Alfred E. Newman mask for a television special.
Sounds a little scary, but okay.
Well, it is. You'll see. It is.
But also art.
Exactly.
All right. In this gallery, there are striking red walls, and it looks like more, well, you just tell me.
A really great compendium to the entire exhibition, and it's a single but very strong, I think, gallery focused on the work of Mort Drucker,
yes,
who was very well known as an exceptional caricaturist, draftsman, and who did many, many television and movie parodies for Mad Magazine over the course of more than 50 years.
As Stephanie Plunkett mentioned, caricaturist and illustrator Mort Drucker had a long tenure as a Mad artist, and his work is the focus of Mad About Mort Drucker, a special gallery devoted to his art within the exhibition. Joe spoke to Drucker's daughters, Melanie Anderson and Lori Bachner, about the importance of their father's work being displayed as part of the art and humor of Mad Magazine.
Norman Rockwell was my father's favorite artist of all time. So the fact that his work is hanging in this museum is more than you can imagine. It's beautiful.
It's amazing to me, given that one of the greatest caricaturists of the 20th century, the greatest caricaturist of the 20th century, and you grew up with that, but to see it portrayed in this way and to tell a life story in a room of art, what has that been like?
To my sister's point that the Norman Rockwell was my father's favorite artist, for my sister and I, it feels like our dad is coming home here to see a huge display of his work, which is the smallest amount in comparison to the breadth and depth that he did, not only for Mad, but the JFK coloring book and tons of advertising that went on in the 60s that referenced that show, Mad Men. He was all that without the cocktails because he worked at home, which working remotely is like, you know, everybody does that. But back in the day, my sister and I grew up having our father home, and people said, well, did he have the door closed that you couldn't bother him? And I said, no, on the contrary, my sister and I would come home from school. He'd put the drawing board up and say, okay, girls, time for milk and cookies. And we'd go upstairs. He'd ask about our day. And it was a treasure to have the first man in your life that you meet, your father, really cares about what you think, what you have to say. And as girls in the 60s, that was huge. So watching him draw, putting pen to paper, was just such a small part of who the man was for us.
Give us a sense of what you think, after all these years, looking at his work, of what makes it special, of what makes it stand out, of what makes his caricatures different than others.
My father had the ability to capture the essence and the personality of the people he drew. So even if you were seeing the back of a character, you knew who it was just by the angle of their shoulders or the way they moved. He captured the heart of the people he drew. And it was just, and to watch him do it, I mean, I grew up having a drawing board in his studio, and to watch him do it is unbelievable. And he is the most humble man. If you ever met him, you'd never even know what he did for a living. He'd want to know about you. And that was who he was. He was unbelievable human being.
It also must have been really neat to be your age and to have someone do something really cool that is so cultural, that is so much a part of our times, so much a part, a reflection of what was going on the screen, whether it be television or film.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what most people also don't know was, like, back during those times, the movie industry was not happy about Mad spoofing their movies. So instead of helping and giving my father 8x10 glossies of the films and, you know, the different things that were going on in the movie, they didn't. So my father would have to pore over silly celebrity magazines to try to find references about what to draw. And most of them were really just face, like head on. So my father had to take that one image and figure out how that person would look in a profile or three quarters. And being able to do that, to make his characters move without any reference material, is quite astonishing. And to my sister's point, I think what makes him the GOAT, the greatest of all time, is that he was able to capture someone's essence without being mean-spirited. You know, I tell the thing about Barbara Streisand, that she had a big nose, but that is not all Barbara Streisand. It's how the nose fits on the face and how it references the eyes and how she carries herself and how she moves her hands. You can almost see his characters when he drew them, that they were in motion. They were not static. They weren't lollipops where you take a head and just stick it on some kind of body. The horse, and my sister said, it was the entire essence that my father would capture and not be mean-spirited.
Mort Drucker's daughters, Melanie Anderson and Laurie Bochner, speaking with me at the Norman Rockwell Museum. Let's jump back into the audio tour with Sarah LeDuc, Brian Shields, Stephanie Plunkett, and exhibition co-curator Steve Brodner, who also has a lot of praise for Mort Drucker's comedy.
One of the greatest caricature artists who ever lived. But as we have been pointing out, not cruel, unlike some caricaturists we can name who want to obliterate their characters. He had apparently no hate in his bones. And truly, I think he loved his job and he loved the movies.
He had to go to those movies, watch those TV shows before he could parody it.
Yeah, but he didn't do the writing. He would get not only the script, he would get the layouts, and it was his job then to put everything together, which seems to be incredible. He'd do 8 pages, and he would do 1 page a week, and they are perfect. They're absolutely perfect. Beautifully done, but also deeply hilarious. Very funny. You laughed your tush off when you see these. It wasn't really one magazine. It was 5 or 6 magazines that you would get. You would get the Don Martin part. You would get the Mort Drucker part. You'd get Spy vs. Spy, Perugias or Peter Cooper, and so on. And you look forward to it. So each one of these artists was signature.
Well, you mentioned Don Martin, the maddest of the mad artists, they used to call him. He had such an unusual style, and it was just wonderful to see because with the sound effects and the crazy people with the crazy feet and the crazy heads, and he inspired things like The Far Side.
Actually, I think he invented his own kind of comedy. He didn't need a joke. You know, some of these things are not really that funny in terms of concept. They're funny in the way he did it. You know, he's like a comedian who doesn't need material, who just walks out and people are laughing right away.
And I remember one that my mother just hated. That was Rapunzel. Rapunzel, let down your hair. Do you remember that one?
No.
It climbs up to the top on her hair and it's her armpit hair.
That would hurt a lot.
It would. But you, when you're 8, 10 years old, you just laugh for 20 minutes
at
that.
About Don Martin, from people who knew him, was that he was extremely quiet and that these drawings were just a little bit of an alter ego for him.
Vibrant inner life. This has been magnificent. We're going to hear more in other interviews this hour. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Stephanie Plunkett and Steve Brodner led Sarah LeDuc and I on a tour of What Me Worry, the art and humor of Mad Magazine at the Norman Rockwell Museum. When we return, we will meet some of the Mad Magazine Hall of Famers and those influenced by the magazine. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
How do you do? The purpose of this recording is to introduce you to the staff of Mad Magazine, so you can hear how each of them sounds in real life. First, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Albert B. Feldstein, and I am the editor of Mad. It's my job. My name is Albert B. Feldstein, and I am the editor of Mad. It's my job to... I am the editor of Mad, and it's my job...
Oh, funny about that?
It is difficult to imagine a time when satirical, irreverent humor was not common across the media. But in the 1950s, anti-establishment humor was not the cultural norm. An iconic illustrated humor magazine that has been enjoyed by millions for more than 70 years, Mad was the first to ironically and humorously poke holes in all aspects of American life, from the movies, TV, music, art, and advertising, to superheroes, celebrity culture, and the political scene of the day. First published in 1952, Mad originally launched as an EC comic book series founded by editor Harvey Kurtzman and publisher William Gaines, with its inaugural issue titled Tales Calculated to Drive You Mad. In 1955, with Mad No. 24, the comic was reimagined as an illustrated magazine, releasing it from the censure of the Comics Code Authority. The publication's now legendary parodies of Super Duperman and Starchy, takeoffs on the classic DC superhero and Archie comics, respectively, launched Mad into the stratosphere. Between 1952 and 2018, 550 magazine issues were published, along with a multitude of special issues, paperbacks, and compilation projects. In this part of the show, we'll meet some of the all-stars from Mad's history. John Ficarra was hired as assistant editor for Mad in 1980, shortly after his debut as a contributing writer. He became Mad's editor-in-chief in 1985, with Nick Meglin until 2004, a position that he retained until 2018. I spoke with him about his memories of working with the magazine's founding publisher, William Gaines.
I'll tell you my favorite story about Bill. It was fairly soon after I started, and one of my duties was to check the fax machine a couple of times a day to see, because that's how the artists and writers were sending in their stuff at that point. Very early in the morning, I go over and there's a fax there from someone who was writing about a friend of theirs in Canada who was a teacher. And what the friend was doing was cutting out marginals, those little drawings in the margins that Sergio Aragonés does, and putting them on test papers and before running them off. So this way the kids, you know, they're a little nervous about the test. This sort of takes the edge off. So one self-righteous parent went up to the school board and said, "This is absolutely unacceptable. I want the teacher fired for this." The teacher really was just having a meltdown because he figures he's going to lose his job. Mad's going to find out about it and then sue them for copyright infringement. But he didn't know Bill Gaines. So I read the facts, brought it into Bill. He let out an expletive, immediately picked up the phone, got on with his business manager. Within an hour, they had tracked down the teacher. Bill had spoken to him and told him not only is he not going to lose his job or be sued, but Bill is going to pick up all his legal fees when he goes against the school board. And the teacher did not lose his job. He was told he couldn't do it anymore, which is patently absurd anyway. But that's the kind of guy Bill was.
I think Mad Magazine was the only magazine that had its lawyer on the masthead. It said the lawyer's name, lawsuits. Did Mad get sued very often? Were there court actions against it?
Well, the biggest one was Irving Berlin. We had done a Mad songbook in the early 60s, and all the popular tunes, and it said maybe sung to the tune of, and then Frank Jacobs worked his magic creating funny lyrics. And one of them we did was to Blue Skies, and we did Blue Cross. And Irving Berlin, who was extremely litigious, immediately got some of the other artists and writers, I should say, and sued us. And in the initial court ruling, it was like 50-50. The judge said, well, some of it is a little bit close to Berlin, so yeah, that is copyright infringement, but a lot of it isn't, so it's pretty much a wash, or Gaines was going to have to pay a couple hundred bucks or something. And Gaines was pretty happy with this because he figured he could really lose this big. But Berlin was not happy with it. Like I said, he was litigious, and he brought it to the New York State Supreme Court. And there, the judge was Kaufman, who, by the way, sent the Rosenbergs to the electric chair in another decision. But in this one, it was a slam dunk for Mad. And he said, "Mr. Berlin, if I rule in your favor, every time somebody warbles one of your tunes in the shower, they're going to have to mail you a 25-cent royalty." He said, "You do not own iambic pentameter." And as a result, that was really the cornerstone of what all the DJs started doing in the morning when they started doing their song parodies. Berlin went all the way to the Supreme Court with this, who declined to hear the case. the little cherry on the top of all of this and why is Mad has been in business all these years. A couple years ago, well, a couple, probably 10 years ago now, a book came out about Irving Berlin. Guess how he got his start in showbiz? Singing song parodies in saloons. There's the hypocrisy that has kept Mad in business all these years.
I think one thing that made Mad very endearing, that it saved its biggest shots for itself. It would parody and satire everybody, but it also would fire its best ammunition directly at itself, which made it endearing, and you don't see that in a lot of satire today.
Well, it was self-inoculation, really. But Mad's credo is trust no one. Challenge authority, whether it be parents, politicians, teachers, advertisers, or magazines and newspapers. Mad was a magazine. We were telling you things that we thought were dumb, but we're leaving it ultimately up to you to decide, is it dumb? Or maybe Mad's off base on this. You know, maybe I have a different opinion.
I remember one back cover. It was Lyndon Johnson after his gallbladder operation, and he showed the media his gallbladder scar. But Mad decided to put a map of Vietnam there. Was that Mad's first, I guess, political commentary on Vietnam? And did it? What kind of response did it get?
It predates me, but it's funny you mention that because it's one of my all-time favorite Mad pieces. A guy by the name of Max Brandel did it, who did all of our photo collage work. And this was well before Photoshop and what have you. He was really ahead of his time. It's certainly one of our first dipping of the toes into the Vietnam War, but we were very heavy into the Vietnam War, especially with the returning soldiers and the drug habits and the drug addictions that they brought back and things like that. We were very, very anti-war in that period.
But Mad would also take aim at the conservative Republicans, but also the hippies. They didn't discriminate.
Well, yeah, we went after stupidity, and you can pretty much guarantee on both sides, on either the far right or the far left, there's going to be stupidity. And that was Mad's job, to try to point that out. I mean, Nick Meglin always, my former co-editor, always gave the analogy that Mad is like a funhouse mirror. And we're just reflecting society back. We really didn't create situations. We just saw what was going on and then pushed them to the absurdity. Like I said, in both on the right and the left, you could guarantee that there was stupidity going on. It was just Mad's duty to point it out.
I think one of the more controversial Mad magazine covers was the We're Number One. And it was the one-finger salute. It said, we're the number one Ech magazine. And I guess some of them were returned, and there was some controversy over it. Did Bill Gaines regret that? I think I read somewhere that maybe some of the Mad people thought it went too far, or maybe they shouldn't have done that.
Not some of the magazines were returned. Most of the magazines were returned. I think that was a case of Mad really existing in New York City and forgetting that it's a big country out there. And I think in New York, I don't think it would have raised many eyebrows, but I think once you got into the farmlands and the middle of America, yeah, so the issue was not widely distributed at all. It was just returned. Bill regretted it to this day. Well, I guess he stopped regretting it when he died in 92. But Bill was one known to hold a grudge, so maybe not. But yeah, he was really upset about it. And originally, you gave the correct line, the number one magazine. And for some reason, this again predates me, it was changed to the number one Ek magazine. And that really took all the teeth out of the comments. I think if it had at least the number one magazine, at least like you pointed out before, it was a little self-reflective. Now it was just bad. It was just a bad call on the editor's part.
What's the legacy of Mad? Not just in artwork, but just in the general society and comedy today. It's stand-up comedians, the late-night talk shows. I think a lot of those men and women grew up on Mad. Know what it's about, took some from it. What was its legacy, its lasting impact?
Well, we're proud to be part of the vast wasteland legacy. Certainly you can draw direct lines between Mad and The Simpsons, the Airplane movies, a little bit of SNL. Certainly Weird Al talks about being heavily influenced by Mad. Lin-Manuel Miranda came up to the Mad offices and talked about how much he was influenced by Mad. So I think across the board, Mad has been certainly effective in influencing people. The other way, and I think this is much less thought of, when Mad first started out, the artwork was very, very considered underground. I think what happened was people who started reading Mad and then went on to careers in advertising and the media and became in positions of power to hire people, say, boy, I would love to get Jack Davis to do this advertising campaign for me. Well, guess what? Jack started drawing for me when he was, I don't know, 19. He's now 35. Jack is still very much alive and working. You can get him. And that was really an explosion of mad artwork into the mainstream. And it was really normalized and no longer looked upon as lesser art.
Ryan Shield speaking with John Ficarra.
Dick DiBartolo is known as Mad's maddest writer, having been featured in every issue of Mad for the past 50 years. As the Giz Whiz, he appears on ABC's World News Now. He was also a longtime writer for the classic game show Match Game, starring Gene Rayburn. Dick spoke with Joe Donahue about his career and what the vibe was like working at the magazine.
You were there almost from the beginning, right, Dick?
Well, my first piece was in 62, so I managed to do almost 60 years there.
60 years?
Yeah, and 55 of them in every issue.
But lucky enough to be part of the usual gang of idiots.
Absolutely. And no William M. Gaines, the founder publisher.
What was it like in that time of coming on board to a magazine that had been around for about a decade when you arrived, as to getting up to speed as to what of what your job was, of what it was that you all were trying to do?
Well, I think the thing was that it was very unlike an office. I'll never forget a woman coming up and if you knocked on the door, we would give you a tour of Mad. And this woman came up and she said, you know, can you show me around? And I did. And she said, oh, my God, this is just what I hoped it would be. I was afraid I was going to come up and it would be a secretary and carpeting and stainless steel railings and a feeling of corporate. And she said, this is like a high school newspaper, which that's what we're going for. So there was no real sense of authority. Gaines would always say, why don't you talk to me more? I said, well, your door is always closed. And he said, well, why is my door closed? I said, yeah, why? He said, because you people come in late, you take long lunches, you leave early. As long as the magazine is funny, I'm happy, but I can't stand to see you coming and going. That's why my door is closed, but it's not locked. So anytime you want to come in and sit down, feel free. So I don't think anybody else I have ever known would have the boss say to them, come in anytime you want and sit down and have a chat. So it was very laid back. And I think that was reflected in the magazine of kind of making fun of authority, because we didn't have much authority in the office.
How would you get a writing assignment? What was assigned to you, or was a lot of it what you wanted to do?
It worked both ways. If it was a filler piece, so there were certain features, there was a TV show and a movie satire, usually in every issue. They were assigned because you didn't want two writers saying, oh, I think I'm going to do a satire on this new movie. And then you hand it in and they would say, someone did it already. So you were assigned the movie or the TV show. And since I had a second career showing gadgets on television, if the movie had a lot of gadgetry in it, like Star Wars and movies like that, I would be assigned those. Now, the other thing was filler pieces. They were the 1, 2, and sometimes 3-page articles that separated the features. Those you would create, they're usually like 3 or 4 ideas, and you would schedule a meeting with editorial. And you would go in and you would say, okay, in this thing, it's going to be letters that cross in the mail. And you would give 4 or 5 examples. And at the end of the meeting, they would say, definitely write this article. This article, you know, it's not funny enough now. We're not buying it. But if you want to pitch it again with a few more examples, we might consider it. And the other 2 are out. So it worked both ways. Writers spent a lot of time creating the ideas. And I would say my batting average was maybe 40% being able to sell those ideas to Mad.
So once you sold that, I mean, I assume the main thing they were looking for was funny.
Yes. And funny and visual.
Yes. And while that was not what you were most worried about, it had to have that component available to it.
Yes. And the thing is, I used to make crazy home movies and stuff. And Nick Megalin once said, he said, you know, it's fun doing your pieces because you consider when you're writing the piece what the artwork might be. And so that would definitely help sell a piece. If it was just a block of type, you might be able to sell that. But it would be easy to sell something that led itself to being illustrated.
I mean, obviously, Mad Magazine has reached several levels of success. But to have a major exhibit in the Norman Rockwell Museum seems to be quite a lovely slap on the back for a publication that has changed many of us.
No, absolutely. I mean, when I first heard it, I said, is it the Norman Rockwell Museum or the Oscar Rockwell Museum that's just one room in a boarding house up in the Bronx? No, it's the Norman Rockwell Museum. Well, the other thing is, Mad over the years has done many satires on Norman Rockwell paintings.
Yes.
So this fit perfectly that. I mean, we're thrilled that it's happening.
Describe the magazine's current state.
The current state is sad.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. So Mad was based in New York for like 55 years. And then Time Warner said they're moving it to Burbank. Now, we're all native New Yorkers. So do you want to live in Manhattan or do you want to live in Burbank? So no one would go. And so they just started the magazine over in L.A., and it only lasted, I believe, 10 issues. And they stopped all Mad with all new material. And now Mad is mostly repurposed material, although they give it a theme. They'll have a science fiction issue. I think the current issue coming out is about comedians. And then there's going to be a Summer Bummer issue. I'm just looking at it now because that's coming out this week. But it's mostly reprints. And, you know, occasionally a fan writes to me and goes, why are you still having anything to do with them? Because the writers and artists don't get paid because Time Warner owns everything. But my comeback always is, I'd rather get an email from someone saying, oh, you know, I read the Star Wars thing you wrote 40 years ago. I still thought it was funny. I'd rather have that than Mad be dead. And Barnes & Noble also does their own version of Mad specials. Again, it's old material, but it's still visible. And I think if it wasn't for that, maybe this exhibit wouldn't happen. So people can still see the magazine.
Dick DiBartolo, what a great pleasure to have you on the program and to speak with you. I thank you so much for being with us, and great thanks for all of the work and the laughs that you have provided for my entire life, and it's just a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. That was great. It's wonderful when you do an interview with someone who knows the magazine, so thank you.
Dick DiBartolo, speaking with Joe Donahue. As we highlight the Mad All-Stars, we welcome Sam Viviano, a caricaturist, artist, and Mad Magazine art director from 1999 through 2017.
The artwork was so fascinating. Every artist had his own style. You knew Don Martin, you knew Al Jaffe, Dave Berg, Mort Drucker. They were all amazing, but they were all completely different.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I think that's what made Mad special, among other things, but it was the breadth of the images, first of all. That's what caught your eye. From the old-fashioned advertising realism of Norman Mingo on the covers to the Bigfoot bizarre cartoony of Don Martin, as you pointed out, at the other end, with so many different things in between. And as a kid, this really appealed to me. I was into the visual arts as a little kid, and it struck me. Now, it was later that I learned that the visuals reflected the writing as well, that the writing went from really kind of simple, wordless
pantomime gags like Spy versus Spy and Sergio Aragona's Marginalia to really deep, intense investigations of culture by people like Frank Jacobs and Stan Hart and Larry Siegel and Dick DiBartolo. And that's, of course, much later, I learned how important that is, that the words and the pictures coexist, that you can't really have one without the other in MAD.
And I think MAD led to other art not outside of MAD opening up. For instance, I mentioned earlier, Don Martin may have led to the Far Side.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's a good point you make, that it's interconnected with a lot of other things. You know, MAD, even in the very beginning, didn't exist in a total vacuum. MAD was a kind of countercultural force for kids in the same way that Mort Sahl or Lenny Bruce might have been for adults, or Elaine May and Mike Nichols. Even visually, it was connected with comic books because it grew out of the comic books, but also in the realm of illustration and advertising. Some people don't know that some of MAD's artists came out of the advertising world, like Bob Clark and Jack Ricard, as opposed to out of comic books like Mort Drucker and Jack Davis.
What about Al Jaffe? He died recently, not too long ago, over 100 years old. The fold ends, everything else. He certainly had his own style.
What about Al Jaffe? Al was a very good friend of mine. And he was 102 years old last year when he passed away. Al was really the senior member of the Gang of Idiots. And interestingly enough, while he started very early on in the Harvey Kurtzman era in the mid-50s, he left when Harvey did in 56. And he came back about a year and a half later. And for the most part, for the first few years, he just wrote. And other people like Jack Davis and George Woodbridge illustrated his articles. And then one day in 1964, he came to Al Feldstein, the editor, and he said, "I have an idea for a back cover gag. You know how National Geographic and Life and Playboy all have these expensive full-color fold-out features? We can't afford that. We're MAD. But I could do a black-and-white fold-in. That wouldn't cost anything." And Al Feldstein said, "That's a great idea." And they did it. And then he said, "Do you have another one?" And that led to 60 years of Al doing fold-ins for MAD, over 500 of them. The thing about Al was he was not just a writer. He wasn't just an artist. He was a tinkerer. He was so fascinated by how things worked and kind of fit together, so that the fold-ins themselves are contraptions. They only work when you actually fold them in, when you actually do some kind of motion with them, interact with them. But he also had the snappy answers to stupid questions. And the thing that a lot of us love about Al, or slightly lesser known, was the inventions he created all those years, many of which afterward, like a decade or two later, really became things like a parking lot that was in a carousel, and a smokeless ashtray. These are things that he did as a gag in the pages of MAD that later became real things.
Very early, there was a man named Will Elder who had a very, very unusual style for that time, certainly.
Well, Willie, as we all think of him, although his real name was Wolf Eisenberg, Willie, who was very, very close with Harvey Kurtzman, actually started out doing comic books. He started with EC Comics doing, inking war comics. And when Harvey started MAD, he started contributing and really found his true calling, because Willie was really very antic. I didn't know Willie well. I met him a few times in his later life. But even then, you could always see that little twinkle in his eye. And he's the one who first came up with the idea of putting background gags into his artwork. Harvey Kurtzman was very precise in what he did for MAD and would lay out everything very, very tightly. But he left his artists rooms to improvise, like a jazz artist within that. And Willie would just throw in all these little gags that later became known as chicken fat. And to this day, we still try to do that in MAD and put in little background gags, as long as they don't take away from the main point of any given panel or article. It's fun because it makes the readers read it that much more closely.
And the covers were always wonderful with Alfred E. Newman. There were strict guidelines if you got the cover, how to draw it, weren't they? Like he had to face directly. He couldn't turn his head.
The trick about Alfred E. Newman is that he's not a real person. In some ways, he's more of a logotype like the Playboy Bunny or Mickey Mouse is used as an example a lot. And Alfred even did not begin with Mad, but existed in various forms for decades before that, going back at least to the 1890s. And the main face of Alfred was devised by Norman Mingo in 1956 for the cover of Mad number 30. And that is the archetype for every Mad thereafter. And when I was art director for 19 years, whenever we brought in somebody new, that's the first thing we said, don't try to draw a caricature of Alfred because he's not a real person. And if you look at Alfred in the mirror, it's horrifying. Everything is off. One eye is lower than the other, one ear is lower than the other. There are two different axes to his face. It's frightening. So we say, if you want to do an Alfred to model, trace Norman Mingo's original and then render it in your own style. But don't try to do a side view. Don't try to do a three-quarter view because they don't exist. Alfred really exists only as a front view and a back view.
Brian Shield speaking with Mad Magazine's Sam Viviano. Mo Willems is best known for his New York Times best-selling picture books, which have been awarded 3 Caldecott honors. Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, Nuffle Bunny, A Cautionary Tale, Nuffle Bunny 2, A Case of Mistaken Identity, and his celebrated Elephant and Piggy early reader series. He's also contributed to Mad Magazine. As we were recording interviews for the special, we literally bumped into Mo outside one of the galleries. He wanted to see the Mad exhibit and visit these images of his youth, especially since he grew up with the magazine. Mo Willems, how fun to see you. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm really happy to be here to see all of this amazing Mad art.
Given your profession, given your success, given what you have done for children's books and for art, what kind of influence did Mad Magazine have for you?
I think anyone of my generation who draws for a living was deeply influenced by Charles Schulz and Mad Magazine. And I read the magazine as a kid. I would get the Fawcett collections of the early stuff from the 50s. And it certainly affected the way I wrote, my sense of humor. Also, it gave me a certain awareness. Like right now, one of the topics that you hear a lot in the news is about packaging getting smaller at the same price. Mad Magazine was talking about that in the early 60s. So I loved everything about Mad, and I also loved the amount of drawing styles in the magazine. Some people drew very realistically. Some people drew incredibly exaggerated. Some people drew very, very simply. And I always felt as an illustrator there was space for me within this family of cartoonists.
Did you gravitate to one of those styles that you watched closer than the other?
Oh, I mean, I think Ergones, just because of the little marginalia and the tiny little drawings, like that was very exciting to me. I love any cartoon that looks like the cartoonist just left, right? Like the ink is still wet. And his stuff certainly felt like I just missed him. And all that's left is the drawing.
That is such a great statement. Now thinking, that's your work, isn't it?
And when I'm lucky, yes. I mean, I want it to feel so fresh that you just miss me.
The pigeon's there and Mo just walked out.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
For you, at what point did you say, okay, maybe getting a check from them would be fun?
Oh, the idea of being able to draw for Mad Magazine was sort of beyond my comprehension. Ultimately, I did. Later in my career, I made some drawings for Mad Magazine. This is about 15 or 16 years ago. I became friends with Nick, who was one of the editors, late in his life. And the nicest thing that anyone has ever said to me was he turned to me once and said, I wish we had met 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, me too. Me too.
Mad Magazine is made up of the self-described usual gang of idiots. Even though he is one of the most successful cartoonists and illustrators working today, Mo Willems says today's pre-idiots, his term, have fewer places to show their work.
Yeah, I think that cartooning will always exist, but you're right. Magazine industry, for me, particularly weeklies, the alternative weeklies, I managed to make a lot of mistakes in those papers. I do think that if you're a young cartoonist, if you draw every day and you put your stuff out there, there is space. But the difference between doing that online and doing that for a magazine is in a magazine, you have an editor, and an editor has knowledge, right? They've been in the business for a long time. And I feel like I've learned so much from editors because they had a sense of the history of illustration.
Is there anything that hampers you from doing whatever you want, in the sense of, I do the children's books, they're incredibly successful, but I should be aware of doing anything, let's say, subversive?
No. The great thing about being a children's book writer is nobody notices what you're really doing. Here, I'm going to connect it back to Mad Magazine. Mad Magazine never told you what to think. It told you how to think. That is what I aspire to.
And how do you tell someone how to think?
Well, you ask questions. Any good story is a question you don't know the answer to. If you are not surprised by your character while you're writing that character, your audience will not be surprised either.
It's fascinating, and we're just finishing up all of our interviews with the various artists and talking about the history of the magazine. There's a magazine, and there's so many different styles, as you say. And then there's Alfred E. Newman, where nobody really knows, like, what is he, round character, but like, what sort of, what do you do with him?
He's a great question mark.
And that's fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any character that you can put yourself into is more fun than a character that dictates to you.
And he seems as if he knows a lot more than we do about most things.
I would say a lot less than we do about most things.
You think so?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the point of connection. Alfred E. Newman, Charlie Brown, all of them. You can sympathize with them, but you also have a little bit of a glee of feeling a little bit superior. That's the pigeon.
But there's also wisdom there, too, isn't there?
Yes.
I'm going to end there. Mo Willems, what a great pleasure to have you here. I'm so glad we bumped into you. Thank you so much.
Great to see you again. Take care.
And I'd like to thank Joe Donahue and Sarah LeDuc for letting me be part of this great, great Mad Magazine special. Mad meant a lot to me. In fact, I had Sister Mary Celine take away a copy of my Mad Magazine in the third grade. So that made me an official Mad Magazine fan once a teacher takes it and rips it up in front of you. What May Worry, The Art and Humor of Mad Magazine, is a new exhibition at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. It's on view through October 27th. To learn more, visit nrm.org. I'm Brian Shields.
And I'm Joe Donahue. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.